I was thinking you were speaking metaphorically, like the Holy Spirit hit you with lightning, but you mean you literally got struck by a bolt of lightning?
It hit the overhang that I was under on Grandfather Mountain and ran up on me and knocked out my nervature and my sense of feeling for an hour.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. In the year 1415, a Roman Catholic priest named Jan Hus was burned at the stake in Prague. The reason? Heresy. The heresy? Well, some very dangerous things at the time. He wanted the liturgy to be celebrated in Czech. He believed priests should be able to marry. And he wanted to eliminate these little things called indulgences. He also wasn't a huge fan of purgatory. If he'd been born just a few decades later, he might have found a good friend in Martin Luther. And actually, a bit later than that, he would have found a few Catholic friends as well. But instead, we know him as the forerunner of a pre-Protestant movement that became the Moravian Church. Speaking of Martin Luther, one of my guests today, a Moravian pastor named Derek, experienced, like Luther, a change of heart in a lightning storm, but I get ahead of myself. Moravians. They are a tradition with a unique and robust culture. They have a really fascinating history, and they were some of the first and strongest voices for Christian unity, even though they were born out of persecution. And they became voices for Christian unity before the ecumenical movement was even a thing. So who are the Moravians? What are they about? Why do they love Anglicans? And what can we learn from each other? Today's episode is part of our full communion partner series. If you want to listen to the other episodes in this series with the evangelical Lutheran folks, you can check out those links in the show notes. Now, let's head to the hills of Pennsylvania to chat with a Moravian pastor and a Moravian bishop who've both given their lives to serving God in this small but mighty denomination that have been a consistent voice for continuing Reformation. Our first guest is the Reverend Derek French. He is pastor of Nazareth Moravian Church in Nazareth, Pennsylvania, and he's co-chair of the Moravian Episcopal Coordinating Committee. Our second guest today is the Right Reverend M. Blair Couch. She's bishop in the Moravian Church. She is also on the Lutheran Anglican Moravian Coordinating Committee in Canada and the Moravian Episcopal Coordinating Committee in the U.S. Now pour yourself a German beer. We're going to hang out with some Christians who, from persecuted European beginnings, quickly found their place among the peacemakers. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Derek, Blair, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Happy to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
Now, you're both calling from Pennsylvania today. Is this because Pennsylvania sort of attracts all the Moravian leaders like moths to a flame? Or are there other reasons you guys have both ended up in Pennsylvania?
Blair, do you want to handle that one or you want me to cover it?
You go ahead.
So there are really two centers of Moravian settlement that are highly concentrated in the United States. Three, if you count Alaska. But in what's called the Northern Province of the Moravian Church, there are lots of Moravian churches in Pennsylvania, especially around the area of the Lehigh Valley, which includes Bethlehem, Allentown, and there's a secondary high concentration down in North Carolina around Winston-Salem.
And so we would have a call to a church, which we then could accept or not. My first 17 years of ministry were in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, in the Moravian Church there, and then got called back here to Allentown and accepted that call. So I think there are times when people will say, would don't want to be close to Bethlehem. It's too stressful and there's too much tradition and I'd rather be outside of Bethlehem. And then there are other times when people say, wow, it's a really neat administration going on there and the churches are exciting and vibrant and I'd really like a call there. So it just depends, I think.
Could you each briefly share with us what your journey into ministry has been? We're doing a series on the podcast of full communion partners with the Episcopal Church. We want to learn about them, what we have in common. finding commonality in ministry lives and journeys and what we might learn together. So I'd love to just start off with your particular story.
So I grew up in a clergy family and always felt that the church was my second home. The community there was very loving. And in about grade five, I felt a call to ministry, but that was 1962, and we weren't ordaining women in the Moravian Church. And I knew I didn't want to be a doctor, nurse, or a teacher, so being a missionary was out. So I kind of thought, I guess I have to marry one. And I was at church camp and watching all of my, many of my contemporaries, colleagues, at the consecration service at the end say they were going to seminary, which ultimately many of them did. And I just kept kind of looking at which one was going to be my husband. And then in 1975, I attended the ordination of the first woman in the Moravian Church in the modern time, and heard in my head when the bishop was giving her the charge, you don't have to marry one, you can be one. And I happened to be living in Bethlehem at the time and applied to seminary and was accepted, and it was the right place. I thought, well, I'll try it out. But it was where God wanted me, and I'm very thankful. So I've been ordained now since 1978.
Wow. Have you pastored several congregations in that time? Have you just focused on one or two? And I know now, you know, you also have served as a bishop.
So the first call I had was to Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, to a church there, and spent 3.5 years in that congregation and had my first child. At that point, I took a leave of absence. And so I was on a leave of absence, but during my leave of absence, I was interim pastor for a number of the congregations up in Edmonton area. And then I got the call to Edmonton Moravian Church in 1986 and served there full time until 1995, when I was called here to Allentown, which was where my dad served when I was in elementary school.
No
so
kidding.
It was really very neat to have Amazing. That loop really kind of connected. And then in 2002, while I was serving the congregation, I was elected a bishop and continued on until my retirement for 20 years, from 1995 until 2015. And finally decided, you know what, this church needs another chapter, because 20 years is a pretty long time in the Moravian Church for clergy to be serving. And so I retired and then continue on with responsibilities in the church as a bishop.
Okay. Are you all like Methodists in that there are, it's usually shorter periods of time and you're more mobile? You know, you said 20 years is an unusually long time.
Our standard has been itinerancy. There's always an openness to a call, an openness to where the Holy Spirit is going to lead. When churches have sold parsonages, so then you have to buy your own house, or when your kids are in school and you don't want to move them, or your spouse has a job that really isn't transferable, you know, those are some real considerations which has tended to reduce the opportunity or the desire for itinerancy. And so I think the pastorates are getting longer for some of those reasons.
Okay, so you're finding that changing
yeah.
in your time. Derek, how about you? Tell us a little bit of your story into being a pastor in the Moravian Church.
So I was not a PK, a preacher's kid.
You were a raging, raging pagan.
you could say that.
Really? Yes, tell us. We want the whole scoop.
No, I had a bit of the hellion in me, the imp in me, always have. Blair might say I still have. My mom was one of four daughters of a Moravian pastor and his wife. And all the other sisters married Moravian pastors except for my mom. So my mom married a professor of classics of Greek and Latin, classical studies. And I had no intention of going into the ministry as a child, even though I had loads of good examples in the family, spent a lot of good times with folks in the family. But about seventh grade, I started getting a sense of call into the ministry. And I thought that that must be wrong. So I tried to bargain with God. And I said, well, God, you know, I'm really an introvert. I'm not into speaking in front of a lot of people. I'm really not into crowds, and this Moravian group is really into fellowship and crowds. However, God, if you show me a sign that, that I understand, I will follow you into ministry. So I prayed for from seventh grade all the way up through 12th grade. Lord, show me a sign. Lord, show me a sign. And I didn't see anything, at least anything that was perceptible to me. And then I went for a weekend retreat with a bunch of friends at the house of a Presbyterian pastor in the mountains of North Carolina. And while I was there, I got hit by lightning.
Wait, Derek, hold on. I was thinking you were speaking metaphorically, like the Holy Spirit hit you with lightning. But you mean you literally got struck by a bolt of lightning?
It hit the overhang that I was under on Grandfather Mountain and ran up on me and knocked out my nervature and my sense of feeling for an hour.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I did not do what Martin Luther did and fall on my face and say, Saint Anne, help me, I'll become a monk. Uh-huh. But I did quit praying that prayer to God.
I would too, frankly.
I said, okay, God, I am very sorry that I've been tempting you. I am very sorry that I've been doubting you. I will prayerfully consider ministry. And so after I finished up college, I got married and went up to seminary, and I've served churches down in Lancaster County in Pennsylvania at Lititz and in Hellertown on the other side of the Lehigh Valley area, and in Bethlehem, and now I'm north of Bethlehem up in Nazareth.
Derek, it sounds like you've got a little more of the he brought me into this kicking and screaming kind of narrative, but you don't seem to be kicking and screaming now. So I'm just curious, can you share something that's been a real consolation or a joy to you about your vocation once you said yes to it?
Almost every aspect of it. Prior to getting hit by lightning, I had major depressive disorder, which the lightning temporarily cured. And I've promised my wife that if I ever feel down again, I'm not going to go out to God and say, hit me with your best shot. So, But I find that the redemption of that experience, because I have had parishioners in every congregation who have struggled with depression, and being able to share our struggles and help somebody else based on what we've been through in our own lives, I find to be an incredible blessing. It's not a blessing that is restricted to clergy, but the clergy has the privilege of being exposed to situations where we can make use of our experiences to help somebody else. Everything has been grist for the mill or a source of possible ministry, and there's always something new. So I find that, and I find the spirit of community, even as an introvert, I find that to be a real blessing.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Speaking of spirit of community, which I think is going to be part of the answer to my next question, I'm curious if you could give our listeners a little brief introduction to the character or the feel of the Moravian Church. What's the sort of personality of this church for people who know really nothing about it? We've learned about Lutherans. We've learned about the Church of Sweden on previous episodes. But like by the time the Lutherans were having this Reformation, y'all were already like 100 years old or something like that. So you've been around for a while, and we'll get to some of your history in a moment. What's the personality of your church? What are some top two or three characteristics that you each would want to share?
One of the characters is that we are both and church. We don't try to limit our worship experience or our Bible study experience, that we can be both liturgical and open and free. But the other that I would say is, so our motto on our church seal is, in English, our Lamb has conquered, let us follow him. Mm. And part of the history is that back in 1741, a synod of the Moravian Church asked whether Jesus might be the chief elder, and the lots said Jesus agreed. And so when we say our Lamb is conquered, let us follow him, we really say that our chief elder is Jesus Christ, and we don't have a head of the church. We have province presidents, and we have bishops, and we have a board that's over the Unity board, that's over the worldwide denomination. But that president changes every so often.
When a Moravian sees a bumper sticker that says Jesus for president, a Moravian says to themselves, yeah, we've already done that.
And it's conferential, so it's not even president anyway. But the other is a saying which is not necessarily unique to the Moravian Church, but it's in essentials unity, in non-essentials liberty, and in all things love or charity. And so that really encapsulates, I think, the character of the denomination. And many people who've come into the church from other places have said that that has just captured their sense of what Moravian is and where they want to be.
I get a sense of ease, friendliness, warmth, sort of a family feeling, maybe not so much formality, though there's not, as you might find in other quote unquote informal denominations, a rejection of formality, or sort of like even sometimes a fear of formality or a fear of liturgical forms. I just don't see or sense that about what I've heard and seen with Moravians.
I would second everything that that Blair said. When you ask that question, of course, it depends on who you're asking. And I think it's important to remember that the Moravian Church is a global church. The province is the basic unit of the Moravian Church, and this is a little bit different from other denominations. And your presiding bishop is your head of communion, correct?
Yes.
For practical purposes and ecumenical purposes, our provincial presidents are our heads of communion. But because we're organized by provinces, those provinces don't have national geographic boundaries. So Blair and I are part of a province whose congregations include Canadians. She served in Edmonton. She was still serving the same province. She hasn't changed provinces. The Moravian Church in Alaska, which contains a lot of Native folks up there, is its own province. The Moravian Church in America, in the southern province, is its own province as well. It contains a lot of people from Nicaragua and Honduras. There are lots of immigrants up here, especially in New York City. And so if you were speaking with them, they'd each have a different answer for you about the character of the Moravian Church. And I find that there sometimes is more formality for folks that are coming to the Moravian Church Northern Province, where I currently serve, who are coming from the islands. And there they've been exposed to branches of the Anglican Communion, and they've picked up aspects of that that are part of their worship, that they've incorporated as part of their worship.
With that being said, we keep unity. And no one's telling any other congregation, this is the way you must worship, or this is how we all will worship. And it's not that it's congregational in nature, it's conferential in nature.
Hello, dear podcast listener. If you don't have plans the first weekend of November, I'd love to invite you to our worship and arts conference, Awe and Presence. It's hosted in a lovely little nook of St. Louis at the Episcopal Church of St. Michael and St. George. And we're going to be asking at this conference how the beauty and the rhythms of worship shape us, body and soul, for life with God. We're going to look at this through the lens of the arts. So topics will range from George Herbert and prayer, to worship with sacred images, to the bodily senses in worship, and more, from some incredible speakers, including poet and musician Malcolm Geit, theology and arts guru David Taylor, poetry scholar Abram Van Engen, communicator of all things medieval Grace Hammond, and liturgy scholar Matthew Olver. If you want to learn more about traditional Christian worship and contemporary life through some amazing conversations, join us. Register and get more info at livingchurch.org/events, or click the link in today's show notes. Today's episode is brought to you in part by Image Journal. Image Journal is one of the leading journals on contemporary art and faith, featuring full-color visual art,
and thoughtful pieces from writers such as Rowan Williams, Annie Dillard, Victoria Chang, Bruce Cockburn, Marilyn Nelson, Kathleen Norris, Padraig O Tuama, and Lauren F. Winner. I know you recognize some of those names. Image grapples with the mystery of being human through exploration of religious faith and spiritual questions, with new editor-in-chief Molly McCulley Brown, an incredible writer in her own right. Now is a great time to subscribe, or you can check out their fall lineup of craft writing classes and film and reading seminars. Learn more about all these things at imagejournal.org. That's imagejournal.org. So your provinces, it sounds like you have just a few provinces, but that they can cover a huge geographical and cultural swath. Is that right? You have a few provinces. Like if you were to look at how many dioceses are in the Anglican Communion, like we would not have time to sit here and list them all in an hour if we said them fast. And I'm curious, what is a gift that comes with having fewer dioceses or provinces, but having them with sort of, you know, you could say open borders where they're covering larger cultural and geographical swaths? What's a gift of that?
I think it's a double-edged sword.
Mm.
I mean, the gift is that when we gather at our synod, we experience different worship, we experience different preaching, we experience different opinions in our committees. The downside is that we couldn't have any more because we couldn't afford it. We're not big enough. That's the problem.
One thing I should share about Bishop Blair, in the Moravian Church, a bishop is a bishop of the unity. So she's not administratively attached. She functions within this province as a pastor to pastors rather than as an administrator. But she's recognized officially as a bishop anywhere in the world that she goes.
Yeah, that makes sense. And she and I were actually, I'm so sad that I didn't have this already recording when we were chatting, Blair, before Derek came on, because we were chatting a little bit about just this very thing, Derek, her role as a bishop and the way it differs from episcopacy or Anglican episcopacy. And one of the biggest differences is that as a bishop in the Moravian Church, you don't carry the responsibility of the administration of the diocese, that's actually usually a different job that goes to someone else, so that you are typically A, required to also be the pastor of a congregation as a bishop, and B, you have the freedom to do a lot of personal pastoral work with people, which I'm sure comes with its own, you know, double-edged sword aspects as well. But I just wanted to remind listeners, because I mentioned it briefly a few minutes ago, that the Moravian Church is a Catholic reform movement that started before Protestantism. So it's quite old. It predated Protestantism slightly as a movement. It started with a 15th century priest, Roman Catholic priest in Prague, what's now the Czech Republic, who wanted the freedom to celebrate the liturgy in Czech, wanted priests to have the freedom to marry. He wanted to eliminate those naughty indulgences, and he did not like the idea of purgatory very much. And he was actually burned at the stake as a heretic. And so I'm curious about how the origins of this movement continue to flow out into the character of the church. And there's a desire for freedom for Christian leaders to make contextual decisions about what their flocks might need. So there's a freedom aspect. But then I don't believe that there was a retaliatory uprising after his death. So I also am seeing kind of the seeds of nonviolence, which I think has been historically part of the character of the Moravian Church. Do you see what I'm getting at? So like, what do you think some of the seeds of the origins of this church, how do you think they've continued to remain distinctives or character qualities?
John Huss, the Czech priest that you, Roman Catholic Czech priest that you spoke of, was sort of the spiritual forebearer of the movement. And everything you said about him, spot on. His followers sort of broke up into groups after that. And there was a violent uprising against the church as it was in that period. And actually, Rome called for a crusade that came in, and a lot of unpleasantness and suffering and pain. Part that became the Moravian Church followed a Czech teacher by the name of Pieter Chalczycki, who was a pacifist. And so that's where the pacifist element entered in at the very beginning. And in the early years of the Moravian Church, it was very separatist as well, so that you could not be a member of the military or a member of the court or a judge and be a member of the ancient unity, we call it, of the brethren.
Was it civil service that was the issue, Derek, or was it civil service that along the line would align you with violence toward another person? Like if you're a judge, you might have to sentence someone to death or to, you know, penal labor, or, you know, you couldn't be a hangman or you couldn't be a soldier because you'd have to carry a weapon. So would it be associated with violence that was the problem, or was it we just need to keep our hands out of the political and civic pies as much as we can to stay kind of unstained from the world and be a witness in that way? Which one was that?
You've got to remember that we're talking the late medieval period, and there was no separation really between church and state. The two worked hand in glove. So if you did anything for civil service or the state, yeah, you were in danger of being morally compromised and not having pure allegiance to Jesus Christ. So I think early on, they were very suspect of any contact of any sort with the powers that be in society.
Okay.
Even to the point where there was a period where they would worship out in the Chalice Rocks over there. They would worship out in the forest under the linden trees and among the rocks and everything. Very, very separatist in the beginning. And then they realized, they sort of moderated their view and realized that they had a witness to the broader society. And so then they started permitting folks who were higher status, who had civil engagements, as long as those persons were able to act in such a way they did not compromise their fidelity to Jesus Christ, especially in the early days. They based it on Jesus's Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes. And we actually have an old hymn from that period that has a line in it translated into English as "Brethren of the law are we." And that law is the law of Jesus Christ as set forth in the Ten Commandments. And there's also a line in there in English, "None but Lord is Christ we own." So very much focused on Jesus Christ, very much focused on Christ. Niebuhr would say Christ against culture, set opposed to culture at that period. Now it's changed over the course of history, but that's a trend or a strain that's very deep in the Moravian Church, and I think persists even in the subconscious, if it's not always in the conscious. It's in our liturgies. It's absolutely in our liturgies. It's absolutely in our hymnody, that understanding, as is the experience of the church being exiled.
That takes me to another question that I had about power and Moravians' relationship to power and being really skittish of civic and political power and feeling like this is something that could compromise our relationship with Jesus. And we do not want to do that at any cost. I see in that, you know, surely this gives a group advantages of having nothing to lose. You know, for example, you don't have tons of money, so you don't own a cathedral. So big whoop, you know, there's no bishop to take your cathedral. So who cares if you worship this way or that, but also the ability to maybe draw close to others who are not in positions of power. I'm wondering if each of you could share some way that you have seen that gift of non-alignment with power. And I think the Moravians to this day have, you guys have never been in power politically, you know, like the Episcopal Church at certain points in America's history has had incredible power and influence in the kind of halls of legislation and cultural influence, et cetera. But not ever having that or having sought that, what are some of the gifts that you've seen come from that? Like, what kind of freedom to follow Christ have Moravians found?
In the modern day context, I'm not sure that that's a sense of freedom. And in the U.S. anyway, I think in our political situation, there might well be people who would say it would be better off if those of our ilk could have some power. Mm-hmm. I do admire members in my congregation right now where I'm worshiping who have been out protesting. We're walking alongside a Syrian family who lost all of their backing. And so that's where I am saying, you know, I need to put my faith in action in a resistance way. Our document that's called the Covenant for Christian Living says we really ought to take up our civic duties. And if we feel a call to be elected, we should go to a public office. We should do that. So I don't know that in this day and time that there's as much sense of that same kind of freedom to do. I would hope that it is our sense of this world is not our home, ultimately, that we could risk whatever we need to risk in following Jesus and saying this is where we believe Jesus would speak and act, and we want to do that.
I think I would second what Blair was saying. When we come up with situations with persons in the community that are marginalized or vulnerable, I always point back to our Moravian history to raise awareness that this has also been our story at periods of time. And while in the 20th century, 21st century, especially if we happen to be Caucasian, we haven't had the experience of exclusion in the United States that a lot of other folks have. But historically, the Moravian Church has at times been aligned with those who were in much less privileged positions. And again, globally, the majority of the Moravian Church is in the two-thirds world or the global south. And if you were to like do a random sample of Moravians in the world, the likelihood that you would come up with me or Blair is slim. You would come up with a Tanzanian, or you would come up with somebody from South or Central America, or maybe even over in Asia. You wouldn't come up with us. So absolutely what Blair is saying in a North American context, and especially so for those of us who are Caucasians, but maybe not so much for others.
I'd love now to turn to some of the encounters between Anglicans, Moravians. The Episcopal Church and the Moravian Church are full communion partners, so we can basically swap out clergy, we can celebrate communion together, we have all kinds of fun together. I am curious how this came about and some of those fruits today. I mean, you all have had great influence in the ecumenical movement since at least the 19th century. So Christian unity has become part of the heart and character of the Moravian Church, which began as a protesting movement within the Catholic Church. Was that the place that Moravians and Anglicans found each other? Was through the ecumenical movement? Or how did we get together? What was our meet cute?
In the modern time, we are called the Moravian Church because of the people from Moravia in now the Czech Republic immigrating into the land of a Lutheran count, Zinzendorf, and his allowing them to live on that land and become the Moravian Church. Count Zinzendorf was the one who was a Lutheran then realized, you know, again, that this movement predated the Lutheran Church, but he was one who wanted to have unity. And so he was the one who reached out to the other denominations or the Anglican Church. And when he came here to the U.S., to this area, he said, we shouldn't have Lutherans and Moravians. We should just have a Christian church, which didn't go down so well. But so that I really believe is the beginning of our ecumenical. And there's a book written by one of our clergy called The Ecumenical Pioneer, which is a biography of Zinzendorf.
And Zinzendorf, was he campaigning for Christian unity? Was this in the 19th century or earlier than that?
No, 18th century, 17. Yeah, this was 17, starting in like 1723.
Mm-hmm. There are links before that, though. John Amos Comenius, one of the early educators in the Moravian Church, took refuge over in what is today the UK for a period of time, and was interacting with the Church of England at that point. And then Zinzendorf also had connections over in the British Isles before the Moravians even came over here. So the connections actually are on the other side of the Atlantic, and then they just continued over here. In the more modern period, basically, I think that both denominations realized that they needed to formalize and reestablish what was already there. And so they had, when there was the process of full communion really took off in the latter part of the 20th century, especially, that you started getting the more formalized agreements between confessions of faith, including the Moravian Church and the Episcopal Church and the Presbyterian Church and Lutheran Church and all sorts of other churches.
One of those hot periods of ecumenism where everyone was drinking their coffee and a lot was getting done really fast. So Anglicans and Moravians, basically, I put this in a nutshell, have been buddies at least through informal relationships and calls to relationship instigated by Count Zinzendorf and people who were, you know, with him in this Christian unity movement since the 18th century. And then there came a certain point where we said, okay, let's make this official. Let's define the relationship, DTR, and then started participating together in the kinds of conversations and documents and research and get-togethers that different Christian denominations were doing during some of the heights of the ecumenical movement. Is that a pretty good nutshell?
That's a pretty good nutshell.
Yep.
Okay, I'll put it up on Wikipedia when we're when we're done with this conversation. Well, if I may ask you just one more question, I'm curious, in both of your work and friendships with Anglicans and Episcopalians in your ministry, what you think Anglicans and Moravians can open themselves up to share with one another right now?
I think that the Anglican usage of sacred imagery is something that's very interesting. The Moravian churches usually are pretty plain, but I think that the use of iconography and the use of religious imagery is something that Moravians might be enriched by exploring. And I also think that the fuller expression in liturgy, such as the Book of Common Prayer and some of the liturgies in the Anglican tradition, Episcopal Church, are also beneficial for Moravians in terms of not only appreciating them for what they are, but also for Moravians to see where things that are familiar to them in worship have come out of a shared tradition that exists, that we share together with the churches of the Anglican Communion, including the Episcopal Church.
Yeah, that's great. And then even farther back, what we're sharing from our shared history with the Roman Catholic Church and with the, you know, pre-schism East and West together church, you know, including our Orthodox brothers and sisters. So I love following that flow back to the fountainhead and sharing along the way. That's beautiful. What would you say, Blair?
Well, and I'll take the other side. And so I'm serving with the Lutheran Anglican Moravian group in Canada with their full communion coordinating committee. And also with my experience with Derek on the Coordinating Committee for the Moravian Episcopal Dialogue, I hear from the Episcopal Church that what the gift that we bring is the lack of hierarchy.
Mm.
Really that conferential system, and we call each other brother-sister very often, and that's one of the gifts that the Moravian Church brings to the more formal, more hierarchical denominations.
May I also add, Blair, that if people are curious about learning more about the Moravian Church, that they just look up some of the distinctive vocabulary that you guys use in your worship and life together. You mentioned calling each other brother and sister so-and-so. That's just so beautiful. I grew up in a Pentecostal denomination where we did that. And even unbeknownst to you, it forms you in thinking of other Christians as family in very profound ways. That would be a beautiful place to glean from your tradition. I've been speaking today with the Reverend Derek French, pastor of Nazareth Moravian Church in Nazareth, Pennsylvania, and co-chair of the Moravian Episcopal Coordinating Committee, along with the Right Reverend M. Blair Couch, bishop in the Moravian Church, and a member of the Lutheran Anglican Moravian Coordinating Committee in Canada, and also the Episcopal Coordinating Committee in the U.S. Derek, Blair, thank you so much for making time today and joining me in conversation.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. This episode was edited and mixed by the team at Sound On, Sound Off. Learn more about their work at soundonsoundoff.com. In 2 weeks, can you find God in a teacup? Jackie James can. Owner of the London Tea Merchant and Tea Sommelier, Jackie joins us to spill the, well, you know, about the art, business, and ministry of a good cup-up. Until then, I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.